At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And that's it. We're live. If you always notice, I'm looking up to the top right of the screen, which for you guys, it might look like the left. But I'm always waiting to see for everything to check off and say that I went live. I don't know why I feel the need to clarify that, but I feel the need to clarify it. Anyways, today we're probably going to talk about a little bit more than what the title of the show is. I know my guy that I have on today is going to know all about this. I want to talk about the human cost of the Middle Eastern wars. Once again, I know he's going to be able to rattle off a whole bunch of information that I don't know, and I would like to believe I'm pretty well versed on this stuff. But also, we were already talking about some diet and health stuff, because if you look at this guy from 2 years ago, you wouldn't even recognize him. And I was just telling him before the show, I couldn't help but gloss about the jawline, the beard, and everything. I mean, he's a stud. He's 10 out of 10. I could see him smile in the green room. So anyways, make sure you hit all the links below where you can find my guests, specifically at the Libertarian Institute. I know antiwar.com is doing a fundraiser, and I believe they might be too, so make sure you go over there and donate. Those guys could really use it, really use the help and really use the funds, because they're doing great work. And specifically, I've had a lot of those guys on my show within the last couple weeks. You know, Connor and Dave DeCamp were on last week, and then this gentleman today is from the Libertarian Institute as well. So make sure you hit all his links and help them out, show him support. Tiger Fitness through the links below for all your supplements, pre-workouts, protein powders, BCAAs. They don't have the multivitamins right now, which are the normal ones I take, so I had to get them from Sam's Club. I know, I'm a terrible person. Deemed Fit through the link below to get some clothes that make you look good when you're all jacked and tanned. And go to Fox & Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout to let them know that the Matovics had sent you. Hopefully I'm going to be meeting up with Steven here soon. But without my rambling carrying on too long like it already has, let's kick it. And welcoming back to the show, my dear friend, Keith Knight. How you doing, man?
Very well, Kyle. Thank you for having me, brother.
Yeah, of course. So before we hopped on air and before we get into all the serious stuff that's going to make everybody want to, you know, go find the closest bridge and maybe take a little bit of a too long of a walk off of it. You were mentioning your fridge looks very sad.
It looks sad to the untrained eye. That's the issue. It's just eggs and beef. Now, the average moron would say, well, oh, this is depressing. I could never do a diet like this. The reason that I'm obsessed with this diet is it helped me lose 110 pounds. And I just viciously hate the USDA and all the government teachers and all the doctors who push that fucking food pyramid. Is swearing aloud on this show. I'm sorry, I forgot.
Oh yeah, dude, you should know. I got way worse of a potty mouth than you. Go ahead, man.
I want these motherfucking doctors homeless after I'm done suing them. That's what I want. Begging for money on the street for all the shit. It's not that I believe everyone who knew that it wasn't fat that made you fat, carbs made you fat, should have told me that. It's not that. It's these doctors who they were happily collecting my insurance information, happily taking my money and saying, what you need to do is insert bullshit, they would usually say. They would never say, well, bread and pasta and fried foods, those are the things you should be worrying about, because I never ate sweets. So this whole time, I didn't know why the hell I was so fat. I'm like, I guess I even have to eat lower fat foods than I'm up, but I'm already at like a zero fat diet. The point is that alternatives are so much easier to come across. And this started because of my post today. What I said was no monetary cost. Of course, there's always an opportunity cost, but no cost YouTube videos did more for my health than thousands of dollars spent at doctors. And even worse, hundreds of hours. It'd be one thing if they just stole my money, but they committed fraud with my time. Years I will never get back. Years I could have spent talking to Kyle Matovic the entire time. They wasted that sacred time. And that's why I basically want them all homeless, begging, having to suck dick for money. That, of course, is just a personal opinion. I don't represent anyone else at the Institute with that. In fact, I probably shouldn't have said it. The point is, we can actually make a change in our lives. We're going to talk about the wars, of course, but yeah, it's going to be hard to get Secretary Blinken to change his positions. Best thing you can do to improve your life today is check out the carnivore diet.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't always recommend that to people, but I try to always give people the caveat, like, look, it worked for me. I mean, without a doubt, I was 250 pounds and I've shown pictures ad nauseum of me, you know, big, and I'm about 5'11". 250 on me was big. I was a big boy. Lost, you know, went all the way down to 180. Right now I'm sitting at about like 205 ish. And I would like to believe I look pretty damn good. I can lift very, very well. But I mean, that was from doing mostly beef, salt, and water. For me, after a certain point, it became unsustainable. Obviously, for each person, you kind of have to assess your individual tolerance. Like, if you can go without certain foods for a while. But I mean, for me, I just love eating fruits, fibrous vegetables, and stuff like that. And the only problem, and I don't think you fall under this, but like, people, when they hear extremes in foods, then I think that they get this disinhibition response where basically as soon as they go a little bit off the wagon, they binge. And this happens to a lot of people. And this isn't just specific to carnivore or anything. It even goes to like vegans, right? Where they feel like an abject failure because they were one meal off the plan. Do you get what I'm saying? That's where I think people run off the rails. And I don't hear that from you, but I hear that from other people. And I don't want this to be like I'm guilting you by association, but this is why I always tell people, hey, carnivore worked for me. It may work for you, but just be aware that, like, hey, my experience was I'd be good for the first probably couple months, bulletproof. Then after a while, I'd be okay. A week or two would go by and I would end up face down a couple cheesecakes. And then another week or two, same deal. And it'd be over and over again. And then eventually I realized, okay, well, for me, now it's best for me to move on to a more flexible diet where I kind of just figure out what my daily caloric needs are. And I kind of, you know, budget accordingly. If that's not for you and you feel the best way forward is low carb, carnivore, whatever, and that works for you in the long term, love it. But if it doesn't, then, you know, obviously just diet's a very personal thing. I mean, food is a very cultural thing too. Something that we do every single day. It's a behavior. It's something that we enjoy with people. So, I mean, this is like a big fucking deal. And people just, like you said, we're not told about this. We're not told about, hey, we're surrounded by food 24/7. Every single event, every single gathering, everything we do is going to have something that has a caloric value to it. And we never like make that connection. And then people get real weird when you change your diet. Like, you've experienced all this stuff. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You go to an event where you don't eat the food that's there. People look at you like you got six heads. It's like, no, this is my dietary choice. And this isn't within my purview of my diet. And people will ask you if you want something. It's like, no, that I don't want it. This is my choice. And I'm not to eat what's here. That's fine.
That's very common. People who didn't say a fucking word to me when I look like Chris Farley and John Candy merged together all of a sudden are very worried that I need to have my blood levels tested. I have zero appreciation for any advice if they kept their mouth shut when I was 290 pounds, getting no attention from any woman. Now it's just my libertarianism, which turns women off. It's not the 290 pounds on top
well,
of it.
Okay, well, but, you know what? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to make sure that this point is laid out very, very clearly for those listening, because we have a bunch of people listening, and I love everybody here, and I love that we're getting to have this talk specifically. But like, you, even if you did the most unhealthy diet, and there have been studies shown where people can still like improve their blood markers. There was a one case study I'm thinking of. This dude literally ate like Doritos, candy bars, and would supplement with a protein shake. And he lost like 30 or 40 pounds and improved all his health markers, right? Just by losing weight. So like what people should learn is that like the vast majority of health benefits come from the weight loss. That being said, you lost 110 pounds. I don't give a fuck how you did it. You did it. That's what's important. That is the most important fucking thing that anybody should fucking care about. But instead, they're worried about your blood levels. Listen, your blood levels are 10 times better than they were 2 years ago. And that's all I give a shit about. That right there.
Exactly. And the reason that I almost mentioned every overweight person that I come across, I challenge myself to bring this up to them. I do it in a very polite way. Hey, can I tell you something I wish I would have known 15 years ago? Because I'd always been overweight. Yeah. And then I make a 30-second pitch. I have never been met with hostility from a heavy person when talking to them about this, because I always do it very calmly, very quickly, and I mention it once or twice. It's the SJWs who say that this is an imposition, and I'm not taking into account, well, maybe they're unable to do X, Y, and Z. Yeah. First of all, every time you look into it, this diet, if it doesn't have to be, you know, a steak every single night. If you get the beef and eggs that I get, you end up saving tons of money. You keep it, you engage in a lot of variety with different spices and different hot sauces. Mm-hmm. So there's tons of variety. Maybe that's not specifically for some people. The whole thing is, the reason progressives are so, meet this with so much hatred, is it goes against the fact that this is a huge narrative by the medical establishment pushing this USDA food pyramid that was wrong. Next thing you know, we can't listen to the economic experts on what the effect of the multiplier has on the economy, or we can't listen to them when it comes to masks save lives, because as Tom Woods showed in his book, Diary of a Psychosis, the states with the harshest lockdowns had no significant less deaths than states that had no lockdowns at all, or very minimal lockdowns. South Dakota was the only one who didn't do lockdowns. The point is that the medical establishment, just like in the days of the Catholic Church calling all the shots, they didn't want people like Martin Luther going around, not because they had all the answers, because they didn't want the competition. Just as any guy does not want his girlfriend talking to another guy necessarily, with the exception of Destiny, I guess. Though guys like that, they demand they do a little more than talk to other guys. The point is, people don't generally like competition, and that's why the free market's so important, because it gives you that discipline. It gives people the alternative to use things. So you'll save money, you'll lose tons of weight. I always recommend it. But just the idea that progressives, we listen to the experts. You become an expert by going to school. That's why the government needs to fund more college. To get into college, you have to have well-funded, you know, K-12 schooling. So this completely flips the narrative on its head. You need big degrees, and you need to talk to experts and spend a lot of time and money before you get good results. Turns out it's free YouTube videos, you save money, and it's average people actually talking about this and promoting this idea. So it flips the entire progressive worldview on its head. That's why thin progressives get vicious when I talk about keto. But the average overweight person's like, oh gosh, yeah, I got to do something. Oh, I heard about that. I need to look more into it.
Yeah. And like I said before, it's just anything that anybody could do to improve their health, it's a W. I don't care how you do it. If it's just walking, hey, maybe you started, you know, you picked up a pair of resistance bands, or in your case, you know, hey, maybe I'm going to start just increasing my fat intake and decreasing my carbohydrate intake. And over time, you feel like, you know, you're more satiated and you're starting to lose weight. That's a W in my book. And, you know, all progress in that respect is good progress. But yeah, to your point about experts, like, okay, well, these people have been wrong about so much. And then not only that, like, if they were all knowledgeable about these things, why are you here in the first place? Right? That's the question that we need to ask, because if they were right about everything, we wouldn't have an obesity crisis. And there's, and
this is more or less a perfect segue. You can ask the average progressive. It's like, we should only listen to the experts. So don't have an opinion on foreign policy or theology, because the Catholic Church and priests and pastors, they can have an opinion on theology. Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens, shut up. Daniel Dennett, be quiet. You're not a theologian. These are the theological experts. Immediately they see through that. If you say, well, you're not a foreign policy expert, so let's listen to the CIA, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, the Council on Foreign Relations, the National Security, State Department. Those organizations are experts, so let's listen to them. Immediately you see, technically, they are the experts, but they also have a very, very invested interest in purveying some sort of narrative that convinces people to think a certain way, which leads to them offering certain solutions which benefit them at the expense of everyone else. So this is why it makes total sense to say all the experts are totally wrong about this. If all the experts have the same monetary interest, they have one, an incentive to explicitly lie, which psychopaths will do without the slightest bit of empathy. And two, the average person will do it and rationalize it saying, well, if I don't do it, someone worse will come along and they'll just do it. And well, I got to make a living. And well, it's not technically against the law. And a good person follows the law. Bad people break the law. I'm following the law. You know, the system can change. But till then, I'm just an innocent actor and everything. So that's a general theory as to why we should not be afraid to question the experts, whether it's in foreign policy or dietary restrictions.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that you got to kind of consider too in this whole deal is, like you said, the financial incentives. I believe the quote was by Madeleine Albright back in the 90s that when asked if starving, what was it, 500,000 Afghanis or Iraqis, if she thought the price was worth it, she said, "We think the price is worth it." And not to mention a lot of this stuff is kind of based on lies. So, yeah, I guess, like you said, it's a good pivot over to the human cost of the Middle Eastern wars. I figured you've been killing it lately on your YouTube channel. I see you've done a whole bunch of collaborations with just absolutely incredible people. One of my favorites is Stefan Molyneux, who kind of got me in this whole world. I absolutely loved all those collaborations. So let's kind of walk through this here. So when did the U.S. kind of decide that they wanted to get involved in the Middle East? Because I know, and most people I think know, that after 2001, you know, September 11th, 2001 was kind of when we decided, okay, well, now we need to launch this giant war on terror. But obviously there was a lot going on before that. So any kind of important history pre-9/11, and I don't want to spend too much time there, but if there's anything you think that people should know pre-9/11 that really sticks out, go ahead, lay that out.
Well, you could go back to Dwight Eisenhower authorizing Kermit Roosevelt in 1953 to overthrow the Iranian regime and replace a much more friendly regime in fear that they were getting too close to the Soviets. The big shift, I would say, came at the end of the Cold War when they built up this national security contradiction in terms when you're dealing with a state. Apparatus, they could have said, all right, well, we spent all this money because we had the Soviets. We had NATO because the Soviet threat was in existence. So now they're not there. We can all just go home. We could get more productive jobs. We could save the taxpayer money. Turns out they did not have the incentive to do that at all. What they did almost immediately in 1992 was generally embrace what's referred to as the Wolfowitz Doctrine. This was summarized in the Pentagon's February 1992 Defense Planning Guidance Draft. A quote from the draft is, "Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival. We must maintain the mechanisms for deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role." So originally the plan was, let's look out for competing empires. This was published in 92, of course. However, in 91 came what is generally referred to by secretaries of state like Dean Acheson, a situation of strength. They said, in order to really show these potential competitors how serious we are, we could engage in an operation to get Saddam's troops out of Kuwait. This would have been in 1991. What Madeleine Albright was referring to in the 60 Minutes segment you mentioned with Leslie Stahl previously, these were sanctions on Iraq after Operation, I believe it was titled Desert Storm, in 1991. Saddam and his troops invade, I want to say, August of 1990. The Hill and Knowlton, they're referred to as a propaganda committee, but a public relations firm, had the ambassador to Kuwait's daughter, her name is Nayaria, give a testimony saying that this was a horrible invasion by the Iraqi regime. They were taking babies out of incubators and leaving them to die on the cold floor. This is not just something that was said at a United Nations meeting. This was repeated by the sitting president of America at the time. This would have been George Bush Sr. And this goes to show the amount of stress that the state uses when it comes to giving narratives to certain things. So that's why in a big wide world where 7 billion people, how many atrocities are committed every day? How many atrocities are committed throughout history? When they focus in on one thing, whether it's babies in incubators, whether it's Trayvon Martin, know that when there's an anecdote that they focus on to justify massive military interventions, a scam is coming. So I would say 1991 was when the Middle East intervention really took off. After the invasion and kicking Saddam's troops out of Kuwait, you had a sanctions regime imposed by the United Nations along with the U.S. Madeleine Albright was asked about, we're being told 500,000 children have died as a result of these sanctions. It seems very unlikely that the number is that big. Remember, it's only sometimes okay to ask about the number of dead people in a certain atrocity, not other atrocities. But in this one, people said, well, let's look at the facts and see if those numbers really check out. In this case, it seems unlikely that it was 500,000. However, I bet it was thousands. And even if it was zero, if China formed a blockade around America, would we say, well, let's look around. We'll wait to see if anyone dies before we call this wrong. We say that if China forms a blockade or even tries to install a China-friendly regime in a country thousands of miles away, that's our business. Right. So blockading the country of Iraq in hopes, in the surface hopes that, well, this will get his people to rise up. So first of all, January 6th was the worst thing ever because people rose up against their government a little, but they want the average Iraqi to pick up arms, even though they don't have a Second Amendment, kill Saddam Hussein and set up their own government. And until then, we're going to starve you all to death. Well, people don't starve to death at random during these sanctions regimes. It's the most vulnerable people who go first. So, yes, it's likely that it was the children who first were the ones to starve. I would say that's a good starting point for why the U.S. Got involved in the Middle East.
Cool, man. That's definitely a deep dive. So let's kind of fast forward there to 9/11, right? We're supposed to believe that they hate us for our freedom. So one day, I can't pronounce some of the names who flew the planes into the Twin Towers. But we're supposed to believe that because we wear blue jeans and we have freedom over here, that they decide to do that. So therefore, if you didn't agree with George Bush that we need to go into Iraq and Afghanistan, then you're with the terrorists. Let's go into that.
I'm going to have to go off memory. On September 20th of 2001, President Bush spoke to Congress and said, Americans are asking why they hate us. They hate what they see in this chamber, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote, and our freedom to disagree with one another. Said something to that extent. So this is why you can actually say the official 9/11 story is based on a verifiable lie. He didn't put any citations. When I was in sixth grade, bad as government schools are, they at least said you have to cite your sources sometimes. He just made this claim without a single citation. So how you can verify or falsify whether or not this is the case, you can look at what the terrorists said. I know what people are thinking. If there are terrorists, why would you listen to them at all? There's a reason that you put murderers and serial killers on the stand, because they do have a point of view. They still have incentives. They still economize in what their reasoning is. That's why you have criminal investigators to look at means, motive, and opportunity. When a woman falls off, you know, a five-story building, well, if the husband took out an insurance policy the day before, you have to look at the incentives. So what is the incentive that the terrorists actually have? We have reason to believe that what they say is their actual motive, because when they commit acts of terrorism, the goal is to have a shortcut to fame, a shortcut to massive amounts of attention that would otherwise be extremely costly and unlikely to come across. So people, very few people knew what Hamas was before October 7th. So you can look at what Hamas said after October 7th, but we're still on 9/11. So we can actually look at the words of bin Laden, knowing that with all this attention he has on him, he has every incentive to say exactly what's on his mind. Whenever you're talking to people, if you gotten on Joe Rogan or something, you whatever you spoke about then is probably what you want the most amount of people to hear. That's probably what motivates you. So here is what Bin Laden said in a excerpt titled Tactical Recommendations. This is, I believe this was in 2003. It's published in Al-Qaeda in Its Own Words by Harvard University Press. He was giving this speech summarizing the events with his conversations with Mujahideen fighters, more or less keeping a diary. He said, "Then the fighters realized that the gang in the White House could not see things clearly, that their leader, that idiot they obey, was claiming that we envied their lifestyle, when the truth, which this pharaoh would like to hide, is that we are attacking them because of their injustice toward the Muslim world, and especially Palestine and Iraq, as well as their occupation of the land of the two sanctuaries." This is in reference to the U.S. occupying Saudi Arabia and bombing Iraq throughout the 90s from bases in Saudi Arabia. This is more or less justified by neocons as saying, well, the U.S. had an agreement with Saudi Arabia. The bait and switch happens right in front of your eyes. They equate the ruling class with the people of Saudi Arabia. This would be like under Trump's administration, if he made a deal with Putin, that Putin could station troops in America just to make sure, you know, we have lots of riots in cities and maybe Putin's military is better at cracking down on them. So you can see surface level justifications immediately for these things. King Fahd was bought off by the U.S. so they could have bases in Saudi Arabia, not because there was a referendum where everyone voted for it, but because they bought off the king. They buy off the ruling elite, and that's how something like this happens. So immediately we see that Bin Laden uses his platform to discuss the injustice toward Palestine, as well as Iraq, as well as the occupation of the land of the two sanctuaries. Rudy Giuliani clearly lied. Some say it was a lie by omission. That counts. They say that I've never heard that we were attacked on 9/11 because we invaded Iraq, knowing that the feeble-minded audience is going to say, yeah, there was 9/11, and then we invaded Iraq. What Bin Laden is referring to, as he goes on, Bin Laden uses the figure 1.5 million in his writings of people who died from the sanctions. He's referring to the bombing and the sanctions regimes and the killing of Iraqi soldiers that he doesn't exactly celebrate any more than Americans would say, well, it's all right if you kill American soldiers. They put their lives on the line. They'd say, no, that's our people. So because of atrocities in what he refers to as the Palestinian lands, he goes on to say Lebanon as well, in reference to the first Qana massacre of 1996, which got the alleged lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, to pledge his allegiance to Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri after what Israel referred to as Operation Grapes of Wrath. There was a second Qana massacre in Lebanon by the Israelis in 2006. This was at a UN shelter. Just absolutely horrible. So in order for people like Constantine Kissin and Ben Shapiro and Yaron Brook to say with a straight face, no, it's all because of Islam, they first have to say the mass murder campaigns in Muslim countries, the occupation of these places, is not something that really affects these people. When you see in the video response I made to Kissin, there's a mother crying because she believes her daughter is dying inside of a burning building that the IDF just sent a missile into. You have to believe she's more or less putting on an act, or maybe it's at that moment she realized that the West is full of a bunch of infidels, and that's really why she's crying. It has nothing to do with the fact that their kids are getting killed, that kids, you know, these women gave birth to, kids that these fathers have raised are getting blown to bits. They're more or less indifferent to that. They don't feel that at all. It's just about spreading Islam.
Mm, yeah, and you see, you have to make a lot of jumps of logic to kind of get there. And I remember back before I really started to educate myself on a lot of foreign policy stuff, I remember hearing Ben Shapiro saying, oh, it's a majority of Muslims that seem to favor Sharia law. And he brought up all these polls, and then he said, okay, so this is why we have a problem with radical Islam. And if you just look at that at a surface level, you're like, oh yeah, Islam must be really bad if the vast majority of, you know, people of the Islamic faith feel that way. And then, you know, we also get lots of propaganda about how those countries are. And, you know, I really encourage people, if you ever get the chance, talk to people from like all these other countries that our country is trying to go to war with. you will get a whole new respect and perspective for these different places all over the world. It's been incredibly enlightening for me to talk to people from China, Russia, who lived in Palestine for a little bit. It's just been absolutely incredible. So, to the average observer, once again, if you heard some people talk about the way that Muslim culture is and Islam, it's pretty easy to kind of go from A to B or A to C, I should say, as in like, oh, well, they don't like us. And, you know, we have all these issues with that culture. So therefore, it must be their religion. But then once again, what's this middle part here? What's going on?
So you can look at what economists refer to as revealed choice preference. This is in reference to the opportunity cost of actually engaging in an activity versus condoning it or condemning it. So when people from Muslim countries say, yes, I support insert X, whatever X equals bad thing, realize the average person you talk to will justify murdering 100,000 innocent Japanese people in one day with bombing Hiroshima. They will also justify the murder of 600,000 German civilians in the dehousing policy that Frederick Lindemann and Winston Churchill unleashed on the civilian population of Germany. They will also justify the murder of innocent Iraqis. They will justify the future mass murder of innocent civilians in China or Russia or Ukraine today for the sake of making sure Ukraine has an allegiance to NATO and not an allegiance to Russia. So it's very common for all populations to actually justify totally unjust things. Even Americans will justify the mass murder of other Americans. They'll say the Civil War was one of the greatest things ever. Abraham Lincoln's statue should be absolutely everywhere. 600,000 American deaths as a causal result of the American Civil War. Some say it's even higher than that because of secondary and tertiary costs of war. You burn down local food supplies and five people get killed in the burning. Well, there's also people who die later because of it. So it matters how these numbers are measured. But let's get off the high horse. The problem is anyone advocating socialism, meaning the institutionalized aggression against private property and people acting in peaceful manners, whether it's American socialism, Middle Eastern socialism, state socialism, private socialism. Private socialism, an example, would be a mafia that doesn't respect voluntary contracts between consenting adults. This has nothing to do with people organizing voluntarily in worker cooperatives or anything. So the problem is the initiation of aggression against peaceful people. That is the central thesis. When it comes to, well, what about insert bad thing about Islam? I don't like Islam. So I don't know what people are trying to prove with this. Either way, if we grant Shapiro, Kissin, Yaron Brook, seems like the whole Ayn Rand Institute has gotten hysterical over this. Even grant, yes, Islam is the problem. The problem is the Quran. And we had a good run from 600 AD until 1991. Now we got to really focus on Islam, though, even though it's an inherent problem. Okay. It does not therefore follow that we should justify the U.S. government engaging in these mass murder campaigns, in these sanction regimes, in these assassination programs, whether it's against General Soleimani, Muammar Gaddafi, Saddam Hussein, because with warfare, the costs are extraordinarily high and the outcomes are extremely uncertain. It would not have been popular to sell the Iraq war on, well, we could, or let's just start with Afghanistan. Imagine if they sold this to us. We're going to fight a 20-year war in Afghanistan, and it's going to be against the Taliban because they allowed al-Qaeda operatives to plan 9/11. Bush, in his book Decision Points, claims that 9/11 was planned in Afghanistan. No citation, to the surprise of no one. So after 20 years, trillions of dollars, tens of thousands of civilian lives, thousands of American lives, the Taliban's going to seize Kabul in 11 days. But for those 10 days, it's going to be democratic bliss and democracy is an inherent good. No one would have really bought that because you have to weigh the costs and benefits, even if you're right about something. In the case of Iraq, turns out there weren't a bunch of Thomas Jeffersons waiting to seize the throne after Saddam was taken down. It was more or less the power vacuum that they always claim anarcho-capitalists are going to create. The state created a power vacuum. in which a guy named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, his letter to Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri is in this book that I mentioned, Al-Qaeda in Its Own Words, by Harvard University Press. In 2004, he pledged his allegiance to them and started engaging in, you know, acts of resistance against the U.S. occupiers. And he lists out, here's the situation with the Kurds. Here's where the Saudis are. Here's the Americans. He gives a list one by one. So Al-Qaeda ended up seizing this power vacuum created when a secular socialist dictator was killed in the case of Bashar al-Assad. It turns out you can't just ask the average person, hey, we're recruiting for a military, so if you want to take off work to go kill Bashar al-Assad and fight against his warriors, we can hire you after we, you know, train you and screen you. They just say, hey, there's a bunch of fighters willing to fight against Assad. Well, it's not random people. In this case, it turned out to be the al-Nusra Front. The guy's name I want to say is al-Muhammad al-Jaladi, who was basically in a formal alliance with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda until 2016. Operation Timber Sycamore is what it's generally called. I'm sure they did a ton of background checks on these people before giving them, you know, long-range missiles and tanks and grenades and, you know, M16s and AK-47s. I'm sure it was all done totally legitimately because the government cares about gun control. But they ended up arming Al-Qaeda in Syria. Libya is one of the more obvious cases that even Barack Obama in his book, A Promised Land, is very hesitant to defend. He goes, was a very quick operation. Gaddafi was about to commit a genocide. We took him down for a fraction of the cost of what we were spending per day in Iraq and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, because Libya had a lack of institutions with democratic principles, it created somewhat of a power vacuum, meaning LIFG, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, ended up seizing large amounts of territory and had literal slave auctions. The case of Yemen, of course, in the fight against the Houthi governments, which were supported by Iran, they ended up supporting AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. This is the organization that allegedly bombed, killed, you know, U.S. troops in Kenya, Tanzania, and the USS Cole. So, yeah, even if you grant it, it does not necessarily follow that giving the government a blank check to wage war on these regions will yield positive results.
Yeah, absolutely. And much like Ukraine, I'm sure we know exactly where all those weapons end up too. to that point, one country that I wanted to cover as well was Somalia. So everybody's familiar if you're a libertarian for any period of time, and this probably isn't much of an argument anymore, but if you told people that you're a libertarian or that you think that government is generally inherently bad, then people would look at you and usually say, why don't you move to Somalia? Now,
at KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
The reason why people say this is because back in, what was it, I want to say around the early 2000s, 2000, maybe 2003, there was actually no government in Somalia, and their standard of living was actually raising faster than in any other country in that part of Africa. But then, of course, the U.S. couldn't have that. So what the hell is going on in Somalia? The now, if I recall correctly, actually the longest war that America's been involved in over the last 30 years.
Of course, it depends on how you define war. I know very little about the Somalia operation. They're allegedly pledging their allegiance to Al-Qaeda. The group with the name is Al-Shabaab. I spoke with one member of the military who was fighting in Somalia and basically said, you know, you would always tell me, Keith, that it's not the private sector that puts the workers in harm's way. In fact, they have an incentive to protect their employees. Right. It's actually the government. Well, I was lied into this work program in Somalia. I was told it would be humanitarian relief, and we're getting shot at by the people we were told we were coming here to help. So I just don't know enough about Somalia. Of course, Scott Horton has a Somalia section in his book, Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. You can get a lot of details on that. more or less his thesis is that there was an invasion by Ethiopia of Somalia, and George Bush more or less greenlit that invasion. So it could seem like, well, you're just pinning everything on the American empire. That is the problem of empires, all the assets, yet all the liabilities. So anything that happens is either sanctioned or greenlit by the empire. So whatever Great Britain did in 1914, they were very likely to have to bear the cost of, because they were the British Empire in 1914. What they did is they gave the French a war guarantee back in 1905 that if they ever went to war with Germany, they would support the French. This gave the French every reason to not make peace with Germany when Kaiser Wilhelm declared war on both France and Russia. Mm-hmm. So the problem is empire's ability to spend other people's money without their consent. They have no incentive to make wise decisions. That's one of the great lessons. And the other lesson that you correctly mentioned was they always compare America to Somalia. The proper comparison is Somalia before and after statelessness. And once you're in the after statelessness area, you have to compare them to other close geographical regions with similar cultures, with similar habits, with similar genetics. Yes, I know, terrible thought crime comparing genetically similar populations. That's exactly what everyone did in the case of Germany when it came to East and West Germany. Very similarly genetic population with similar cultures. People were escaping so much from the East to the West that Khrushchev said, we had to make abandoning the Republic a crime. So for the sake of East Berlin, East Germany, he built a wall keeping people in. He wrote about that in Khrushchev Remembers, which was translated by Strobe Talbot. Has a very good reputation as a book, so we have reason to believe that it's accurate. Same with North and South Korea. Very genetically similar populations. The South more or less embraced much more free market reforms, even in the days of Syngman Rhee to President Moon today. Whereas in the days of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-un now, they have a very, very tightly state-regulated economy.
Right. Correct. So let's move on to Yemen. So me and a couple other friends were kind of debating the term genocide when it came to Yemen and Gaza. If you look at the definition, then you could argue the definition is pretty ambiguous. And let's be honest, it kind of is. When you consider how many people died in Yemen and the fact that I think they knew what was going on, I think you could plausibly say that when I think the overall amount of people who died in the 5 years that we were heavily involved in Yemen from 2015 to 2020, if I remember correctly, if you say about 400,000 people died as a result of, you know, a blockade from Saudi and the US, I think you could kind of qualify that as a genocide, and also all the drone strikes and stuff like that, and then as well as Gaza. But let's kind of start with Yemen.
When it comes to whether or not something is or is not a genocide, looking at the numbers plus the intention of the people behind the operation, that is the general criteria. So I guess what you could also look at is what available alternatives these people had. So when you look at the case of Yemen, this would have been from 1999 to 2015. It generally seems like the bombings in Yemen were attacks on AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. I want to say it was 99 in response to the cold. This is really taking me back. Then the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia sought that its sphere of influence was being threatened by the Iranians having a friendly relationship with the Houthi rebel government, which overthrew the, Saleh, I think his name was, the current regime that was more favorable to Saudi Arabia. So the American Empire and the Saudi Arabian Empire more or less engaged in what, if any other group did this, it would be referred to as conspiracy to commit mass murder in Yemen, in the hopes of making sure there wasn't an Iranian-friendly regime on Saudi Arabia's border. When you look at the numbers of 400,000, when the numbers get that high and the justification is so loose, they don't want Iranian-backed regimes on their borders. I would say that because the numbers are so high, because there were so few attempts to even shake hands with Iran, because there was clearly positive relations with Iran when Israel was selling them weapons during the Iran-Contra affair, when they were arming the Iranians to fight the Iraqis, not to mention arming the Iraqis when Saddam Hussein went to Iraq and shook hands with Saddam Hussein. So because their lack of attempts to engage in alternative methods of dispute resolution, along with a very high number of civilian casualties, you could say that it was at best a terrorism campaign where they just want to terrify the population into submission. Mm-hmm. When it comes to whether or not it's a genocide, the reason I think it's less important is it's still tons of innocent civilian life. So if you're going to raise such a high metric of, we have to get to that definition in order to really make our point, it's still just as bad. I would say these are at best ethnic cleansing operations in the case of Gaza, mass terrorist campaign operations in the case of Yemen, and genocide. Gosh, I'm just not going to tie myself to a definition. I'm sure. Open to being wrong about whether it is or isn't. Of course, Connor Freeman, my colleague at the Institute, who knows a lot more about this, is on record saying he absolutely believes it's a genocide. And the South African case at the International Court of Justice proved that. Norman Finkelstein, who never called it a genocide until he read South Africa's case, and he's been talking about this since the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Yeah. He said that now it is, because now it's basically just open season. There's, you know, X number of tons of rubble. This indicates that they're not just focusing on military installations, but civilian ones as well. But if that's the metric, you have to realize that Winston Churchill had Frederick Lindemann, who was his science advisor, according to his own biographies. This isn't just someone I made up. If you read his biographies, Lindemann is referred to as Lord Cherwell, C-H-E-R-W-E-L-L. He basically devised a dehousing program on the basis that our research has indicated that to make someone homeless can cause worse psychological trauma than even losing a loved one. So really, the way to get at the National Socialist government of Germany is to diminish civilian morale to the point where they don't have a fighting force, and they're just so desperate to get their next loaf of bread, carbs, that they're willing to just stop obeying the current government that's ruling over them. That's the general justification. So we have actual examples of indiscriminate terrorist operations by the great statesmen. Even General Sherman in the South in America engaged in the same thing. So we know that these precedents exist historically. Do they necessarily apply? Is it a perfect comparison? Probably not. At best, they're mass murder campaigns. They're huge violations of the private property ethic. That's why libertarians need to be at the forefront of all these conversations, because we're actually the ones who say, this is exactly what our philosophy is against, non-aggression, whereas others have to say, well, is it in the interest of the workers? Well, is this a traditional thing that's been done? And we need to embrace tradition. It's only the people advocating the non-aggression principle who are really able to analyze this on principle.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's always interesting when I hear people say that there's a different morality in wartime than there is in peacetime, which I can kind of understand where people are going with that. But that also sounds kind of like a cop-out to say, we're just going to do whatever we want to do, regardless of how heinous that is. A friend and I were talking about Israel and Palestine. It's kind of funny because he comes from a little bit more of like the left-leaning position. And I come from a little bit more of the right-leaning position. And he's, I don't want to say pro-Israel, but he definitely seems a little bit pretty quick to pull the trigger on Hamas. And I'm not here sympathizing for Hamas, but he says, oh, well, they do all these human rights abuses. They leave bombs on corpses and they do hide stuff in hospitals and stuff like that. But then, of course, my retort always is, well, you realize Israel is bombing hospitals. And yeah, you could say they leave leaflets on top of hospitals. But Keith, if I were to tell you that, hey, I'm going to, let's say in a hypothetical world, YouTube, that I'm going to put a bullet into you if you're in that chair in 72 hours. If I break into your home and do exactly that, is it still okay? In my opinion, no. I don't think it's okay to destroy a hospital, even if you warn somebody that you're destroying a hospital. I don't see how this is like a large leap in logic, but, you know, of course we always hear that Israel is the most moral army, and I'm sure that, you know, there'd be people who argue that the U.S. has a very moral military as well.
Well, hey, if you want to try breaking into someone's house, it's like, I bet the average Ring doorbell camera will provide better security than the IDF did on October 7th. Those Ring doorbell cameras, yeah. When you walk within 30 feet of them, they start binging, they start recording, and the owner of the house is alerted on their phone immediately. Apparently, the IDF had to wait hours and hours before they could respond to this, which you could, you know, chalk up to, well, even though it's one of the most surveilled geographical areas on the planet with remote-controlled machine guns pointing into it, drone security constantly, maybe their eye was off the ball and it was just incompetence.
Either way,
yes, there was a report that the head of Egyptian intelligence warned Israel, hey, there is what was referred to as Operation Jericho Wall, is what a number of people in the IDF suspected was going on with a, you know, higher degree of activity in certain areas in Gaza. That's what this was reported actually by the New York Times, to their credit where credit's due. Mm-hmm. Operation Jericho Wall is what they named it at the time. It ended up being Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, I believe it's pronounced. Yeah. Governments just don't have the incentive to keep their population safe, because when they're not kept safe, they get more money and more power, and they have this rally round the flag effect by their populations. After President Bush didn't keep us safe on September 11th of 2001, he was met with a 91% approval rating. Franklin Roosevelt didn't get impeached when he didn't keep us safe in December of 1941. He got basically a blank check from even the American First Committee, who was like, well, now basically we have to go into this thing. So, governments just don't have the incentive. So we should almost expect that they don't keep us safe, knowing that there's a big reward for it on the other side of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So when it comes to Gaza, what's your opinion on the death toll there? I've kind of talked about this on the show ad nauseum, but I'm kind of curious your thoughts.
I would guess 43,000. Mm-hmm. I know... a lot of realists, John J. Mearsheimer supporters who were very active online, say that they believe the Lancet report of 187,000, I want to say. Of course, just like what I mentioned earlier, when you bomb a certain geographical area, there are the people who were killed in the strike, and then later people who died as a cause of result of not having access to products and services that were destroyed in the strike. So it's very hard to...
So the 180,000, is that wounded and dead or just dead?
That's dead, according to the Lancet report and people who have repeated it. Granted, I have not read that in full. And it's so hard. I mean, what is press... It's hard enough to get crime stats in America. The FBI just revised their crime stats. Imagine trying to get death stats in... you know, the Donbass region today or in Gaza today. It's, you're just going off guesses. That's why instead of quibbling over the numbers, we should say, you know what? I'm pro-life, and these mass murder campaigns are very anti-pro-life. I support the working class, and wars are the greatest detriment to the working class, because so many working class people get their limbs blown off and get their houses destroyed that they work their entire life to try and pay off. So we just need to let these people know that they don't have to say, you've been wrong, embrace libertarianism. We could say, by your own metrics, you should be opposing these operations without reservation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what would you say to the average left-wing person who said, hey, all of those Middle Eastern wars that we fought over the last 20 years, they were all justified, and we think that whatever cost we deemed were worth it. How would you argue that with a left-leaning person?
A leftist person, I would say, how would you measure the costs? If you say that there are benefits, I'd be very interested to hear what those benefits are, conceding people like Bill Kristol and Max Boot have even said, well, there was quite a lot of treasure and blood spent on these wars without direct benefits. So Bill Kristol, in his discussion with Scott Horton, actually used the example of, I want to say, Kosovo, as far as the last great military operation. There was Kosovo, the Second World War. Other than that, we should probably stay out of military conflicts. So I would ask them what they thought the benefits were. You want to first weigh the alleged benefits and then look at the costs, both monetary costs, the cost of human death. Cost just means anything that is foregone or spent, any scarce resource that is no longer available as a cause or result of engaging in something. People like David Swanson, who I generally respect, assume that when I say the cost of war, I'm literally only referring to the monetary cost. Not even close. The cost of human life. Then there's the cost of people getting physically injured, getting a limb blown off, getting your leg broken, even the post-traumatic stress disorder from either witnessing villages that you live in go up in flames, the trauma of having foreign troops, you know, going down your streets in military vehicles, anything that would terrify. China's not even allowed to be a little involved in an app that people can voluntarily download on their phone. Yeah. People are like, oh, we got to ban this app immediately. But they're like, yeah, I guess American troops can, you know, just occupy places and the people won't really be upset about this or anything. So, okay. Once listing the costs, I would say, what demographic would you say most bears this cost? Is it just a bunch of one percenters that are negatively affected? If your entire philosophy is, I'm on the side of the downtrodden, the vulnerable people, the little guy, which they belittlingly explicitly say, the little guy, as if they support such a thing. Mm-hmm. It's actually these people who have to bear the worst costs in war. If you're afraid of people getting rich and too rich, well, there are people who make a great deal of money in the involuntary sector known as politics. When it comes to Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, when it comes to the State Department, politicians get a lot of monetary wealth and a drastic increase in their social status as a cause or result of these things. So if you think paying someone a low wage for a job or not offering them health insurance along with the job is exploitation, it's not 1/1000th as bad as killing them. Because these wars engage in the mass killing of innocent, vulnerable people, you, by your own metric, should oppose them. That's what I would say.
Mm, beautiful. Yeah, so overall, what would you kind of, and this might be a little bit difficult to articulate or to maybe get a good count on, but what would you say, like, the total number of dead and let's go with the overall cost of the Middle Eastern wars over the last 25 years. And I know that is a big question, but if you had to kind of wrap your brain around it.
So I would, I do have this study by the Watson Institute at Brown University. Coalition partners have died in large numbers, approximately 177,000 uniformed Afghans, Pakistanis, Iraqis, and Syrian allies have died as of November 2019, before the operation in Gaza, before the death count in Yemen even could have been gone over. So these numbers are so difficult. I think the Watson Institute is something in the millions. Let me see if I actually have that number, just because they seem pretty good overall. The other Watson Institute, between 2017 and 2020, this is when Trump was in office, concluded that under President Donald Trump, civilian deaths increased 330% from the previous administration.
But I thought he was the anti-war candidate, Keith. That's what everyone keeps telling me.
You know, he might be, considering everyone else is so much more of a psychopath, but it doesn't mean we should be bragging about him. Okay. September of 2021, Brown University published a report from the Costs of War Project, which states that 20 years of the post-9/11 wars have cost the U.S. an estimated $8 trillion and have killed more than 900,000 people. That is September of 2021. So it, of course, does not include the mass murder campaign in Gaza. I don't know how other competing numbers and what the difference is in their metrics. Cost of war, I think, has a very good reputation. So that is what we are looking at when it comes to the human cost of the war on terror. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you had the financial cost there from that paper at about $8 trillion, which is just bonkers. I was hoping you were going to be able to find that paper, because that's the one that kind of immediately popped in my head when I asked that question. And yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think that there are still people to this day, including people, you know, on both sides of the aisle, let's be honest here, that are still, you know, still think that all this stuff was worth it and that we should have did it. I mean, Rudy Giuliani was getting a prime speaking spot at the Madison Square Garden rally, along with Howard Lutnick. And then, you know, obviously you have Bill Kristol in the Democrat Party. Joe Biden kind of looks back and says that he never really supported it, even though he was kind of like a big, you know, hand making sure that all this shit happened. So, I mean, there's still people to this day that, you know, overwhelmingly supported all the terror wars.
Unfortunately. So when you hear someone like Biden say, well, looking back, it may or may not have been, you know, the best move at the time. Mass murder campaign, 900,000 deaths and $8 trillion, and they're on the fence about it. Now, when it comes to whether or not there should be antitrust laws, absolutely, we need to regulate exchanges between consenting adults. What do you mean this is up for discussion? Of course we need a minimum wage. 900,000 deaths? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not, or they'll refer to it as a blunder. Imagine if someone... I hate playing this game. It's so boring and predictable. I get it, but if any country committed the atrocities in America that led to 1,000 deaths, 10,000, 900,000 deaths, would you say that was a blunder on their part, or would you say that was inherently evil?
Yeah. Well, what would we say if China did that?
I don't even know. They say everything already. Seth Moulton, this is cited by Connor Freeman's excellent article, Washington Wants War with China, Hot or Cold. Washington Wants a Hot War with China, I believe is the title of the article. He cites a sitting congressman, Seth Moulton, a Democrat from Massachusetts, who said, we should make it very clear to China that if they invade Taiwan, which includes a blockade, by the way, because it's a violation of independence, that we should blow up TSMC, which is the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, the very thing that Ramaswamy tells us we need to protect. It's like, you guys constantly say, we trade too much with China. Okay, then if China takes Taiwan, we'll just keep trading with China. What's the big deal? Why don't you build the fact? Why don't you abolish regulations in America and encourage the chip manufacturers to produce here? This is the nature of the state, where they don't look to common sense alternatives because they don't have the incentive to do so. They're spending other people's money that's given to them involuntarily. They have access to a printing press. Of course, they're not going to economize on the monetary cost. They can frequently, in many countries, and even with the Selective Service Act, courtesy of Jimmy Carter, they still claim the right to conscript people into fighting these wars. You don't have to voluntarily fund it, and you don't have the right to voluntarily opt out of fighting in it. Of course, they support Zelensky, who at this point has claimed the right to conscript men ages, I want to say, 25 to 50. All men ages 18 to 60 don't have the right to leave. More sexism. I'm sure the feminists are very up in arms about that. Just a blatantly sexist policy. So when it comes to what would they say, they already say the most psychotic stuff based on absolutely nothing. I heard Scott Adams say China apparently is hacked. Trump's phone and Vance's phone. It's like, okay, there's another organization that hacked everyone in America's phone called the National Security Agency. If we can declare war on China for hacking two phones, what do we have the right to do to the NSA and the FBI and the CIA? It's just so boring and predictable. And it's primarily a result of the state funding education, which gives us these absolute retards at universities, which yields us the corporate press, which does not want to say anything that opposes state power.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Well, last question. The elections, Jesus, what is it? 10 days away. I'll be 30 years old. No one's going to wish me a happy birthday because I'm not voting this election. I'm going to hurt everybody's feelings. So if you want me to vote for Kamala, no. If you want me to vote for Trump, no. So sorry, people. I know you're upset with me. Or do you think, and I think I already know your answer to this, if Kamala wins, do you think she's going to end the war in Gaza because she seems to be really sensitive to those Palestinians?
No.
And if Trump gets in, someone who I actually really like argued with me that there wouldn't be as much support for a potential war with Iran if Trump gets in.
seems extraordinarily unlikely given his rhetoric, given there's no, here's what we, he'll say things like Afghanistan was wrong, the pullout was really bad, not the mass murder campaign, the way they pulled out was okay. Thank you for the great insights, Mr. Billionaire. It must have access to great education with all that extra funding that he has. So we just have no reason to believe. They don't have the incentive, and they haven't even shown the desire to do so. Say that Jill Stein pulls it off and she gets elected. Okay. She wants to drastically increase the amount of money that the government has access to by taxing the rich and increasing taxes everywhere. It's really easy for even the most well-intentioned people to drastically increase the amount of resources the government has. And then she wants to put a sticky note on it that says, this can only be used domestically. Well, once you have such a power vacuum, you're not going to be calling the shots after this. You might get assassinated. You might say, well, Congress tied my hands and we had to spend the money now on warfare. So whether it's Trump, Kamala, or Miss Jill Stein, the most well-intended person, once you drastically increase the power of the state, you're no longer calling the shots. It's the equivalent of saying, we should give the Ku Klux Klan a ton of rope, the right to make legal decisions. We should give them the right to regulate things, and then they should be a nice organization afterwards. Well, once you give them that power, they have no reason to listen to you. Once you give the state even more money that Bernie and AOC and Jill Stein want to give them, they have no incentive to listen to you after that. And the politicians, of course, have no incentive to actually give you what you want because they're running for re-election and they're wanting to endorse their next candidate on the ballot. So, look, they just don't have the incentive. That's the basic lesson of economics. Look at the incentives people face. That's why this joke about Ron Paul was right, all roads lead to Ron Paul being right. J.D. Vance correctly said the other day that the problem with BlackRock is when you have a central bank, they're able to outcompete everyone else because they have access to lower interest rates, 7% for the average person, 1.5% for BlackRock. This is a huge problem when you have a central bank. The reason Ron Paul was so right about so many of these things is the average imbecile looks at the wording and the alleged intentions of certain legislations. Ron Paul would look at the incentives created by the legislation. So when he saw that Sarbanes-Oxley said, we're going to protect consumers from facing another Enron, Ron Paul didn't take that seriously, correctly laughed it off and said, well, this is going to increase barriers to entry for other companies, and this is going to create more oligopolies, and there will be fewer IPOs, initial public offerings, than there were in previous years because it's harder to become a company and have an IPO in the first place. And of course, he was right. By looking at the incentives, we're able to make better assumptions about what the future will hold because every person, evil people will actively lie and good people will come up with rationalizations afterwards. So that, I think, is the lesson. I don't know how else I can weasel out of your question about what Trump or Kamala would do with regard to Israel. They're just a bunch of psychotic cowards who have no incentive to do it. That's my answer.
Yeah, well, no, I'm glad you laid that out. And this is something that just amazes me because I think you and I are in agreement here. I've been listening to all the campaign rhetoric from both camps, and it's like, wait, you guys are like buying this? You realize that like right now is the time they need your vote the most. So their incentive is to give you the most radical and greatest sounding platform they possibly can, served you on a fucking platter so you'll eat it up. And then they're going to take your vote and give you nothing in return because you have no power over them at this point. Right now, that's not to say that every vote is, you know, has some giant looming power over the president, but they're looking for something from you, and that something is your vote. I'm not telling people how they should vote. I don't care what you do. I can't control your vote. But I'm just saying, realize that campaigning politicians say a lot of things. And they typically don't do a lot of things once they fulfill their campaign and get elected. Or even worse yet, in some situations, you donate a lot of money, you vote for them, and they don't get elected. And now you're out a bunch of money that you donated to them.
Well, look at the downside. So if Trump does not abolish the income tax and replace it with tariffs, if he doesn't abolish tax on overtime, if he doesn't abolish tax on tips, does he go to jail? Has he said, I will have the FBI arrest me if I haven't accomplished these three things by this date. Because remember, on Joe Rogan, he said on day one, I'm going to, he said like four or five things. He had a great line where he goes, maybe day two, I don't know if I'll be busy. I forget when he said that. It might've been on Rogan, but it was actually a funny line because it's like, yeah, day one, really? Yeah, that's going to be at the top of your priority list. So because they're not saying, well, when you have a job, you can say, I will show up on time. The other side of that equation is the understanding that, and if you don't show up on time, you get a warning, you get a second warning, then we fire you. With this, it's like, do we get to have a citizen's arrest if he doesn't come through with his good promises on anything? So again, that you don't have this market feedback mechanism that you have in so many other aspects of society where that competition is the check and balance that governments pretend to give us with having the courts are different than the Congress, which is different than the executive. These groups just get together and get on the same page about certain things, more or less. Every now and then you get a victory out of the Supreme Court, which is surprising. So, yeah. And the reason focusing on the incentives is so important is because the statists, the socialists, neocons, progressives will constantly fabricate historical narratives. They'll say, well, Hoover during the Depression just sat on his hands. He was a laissez-faire president. It was Roosevelt that really came in. What happened was the reason they engage in these fake narratives is so they can say this can be done through government. The problem with government is not the monopoly on the currency, not the right to issue taxes, not the right to conscript, not the controlling of compulsory education. That doesn't really make a difference because we can have good people like Winston Churchill and Lincoln and Roosevelt. In just the case of the Great Depression, realize how many people, including Paul Krugman, believe the myth that Hoover was laissez-faire when statistically, like, well, what should you expect? Hoover's a laissez-faire president. We should see Hoover get into office, massive amounts of deregulation, abolition of agencies, and the budget continues to go down for his 4 years. At the end of his 4 years, he had increased government spending by 48%. The idea that the New Deal, that's according to econlib.org. In the case of the New Deal, we should see, well, you had the implementation of the New Deal, and then unemployment went down and down and down until it got to normal levels. There was a double dip recession in 1937 as a cause result of this, where unemployment shot back up to 20%. So these historical narratives that are so widely believed, that are so widely accepted, not just by the average person, but by the expert class, which claims the right to uniquely rule us, not just the democratic population, they're so often wrong. But the reason that they engage in these fake narratives is because they know the opportunity cost of the average voter to really get informed on each individual issue and proposition and the background of each politician and judge is so costly that they just tell you a story and they lie about that story because they want more money and power. Everyone wants more money and power. What makes the political process unique is you don't have the freedom to disassociate with them, which is why their desire for power is so much worse.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Keith, it's always a very, very enlightening chat, man. I absolutely love talking to you on and off air. Go ahead, plug your stuff. Was I right? Is there a fundraiser going on for the Libertarian Institute? And if so, tell people where they could support that, support you, and all that good stuff.
If people want to support the Libertarian Institute, they can check out libertarianinstitute.org, go to our donate page. We are a 501c3. We are providing the free education that progressives pretend to offer people. They can either donate and write it off their taxes, or they could get one of our books in exchange. Once you donate a certain amount, you could pick a series of books that you would like to get in exchange as a gift. Check out libertarianinstitute.org. We have a number of great writers. We have a good variety of things. We have short blog posts, longer articles. We have a number of books we've produced on everything that ranges from economics to philosophy to foreign policy. You can use our search engine and just type in anything you're interested in. My current thing is Winston Churchill and the Pearl Harbor myth, just because ever since Daryl Cooper went on to Tucker Carlson's show, it's been getting a lot of attention. So I said, you know, I've done tons of research on this. It might be time to get a payoff from that. So people can check out my article titled Justifying Evil, the Pearl Harbor Myth and Atomic Bombings. Also, The Ultimate Refutation of the Churchill Cult. Those are two places to start. And you can get a free PDF of Domestic Imperialism. How could you not want this book? This is basically 15 years of research summarized into 100 pages or so that that we make freely available to anyone.
Beautiful. Yeah, you know, I'm going to have to check out those articles on Churchill, because I've been listening to Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, and it is just fascinating for anybody that's interested in history. I'm not really a history buff because I'm just far too stupid and can't contain any more shit inside my skull, but it's been very interesting learning about that. So yeah, make sure you go check that out. I know I'm going to. Keith, anything else?
Nothing else, Kyle. Thank you for having me.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Keith. All right. And thank you, everybody, so much for listening. We had quite a bit of listeners live. So once again, thank you guys so much for listening. And tomorrow I have on another fellow from the Libertarian Institute. Our dear friend Brad Pierce will be coming on tomorrow, and we'll be talking about the Kamala Harris ad. And then Wednesday, my dear friend Pete Quinones will be back on. So a little bit of a busy week. So everybody, make sure you tune in. And until next time, everybody, take care.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.